All right, here we go. We're back again with another weekly Sheep Farm podcast. This is episode 204. Format is simple. We release 4 shows a month. Members get full access to the podcast plus download. Non-members get part one. All shows are released on Saturday at sheepfarm.co.uk. Sheepfarm.co.uk. Podcasts are also released on Podomatic that send them out to Spotify, Amazon, Audible, Google, and Apple. I've even started putting the links to some of these on the emails that people get as well. So you can go straight to Google or straight to Amazon and Spotify, I think I put on there, or it were Apple. I'll try and keep adding a few on there so people can go direct to wherever they want to go to and don't have to go through Podomatic. All our back videos from 2020 or 2021 are backed up on Odyssey. Or most of them are anyway. All the old stuff that I used to put on the short videos from the news in 2020 and all the other nonsense that were around at that point are all on Odyssey if you want to go and have a glance there. Subscribe to the website so you get email notifications if you want to. If you don't want to, they're always released on Saturdays, so sheepfarm.co.uk is the place to go. You can join us on Instagram as well. Chris is adding up a few subscribers on there.
Yeah, yeah. Instagram ho, I am.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a look how many we've got. To be fair, I've got 1,093. But I put the drawings that usually go with the show on there. Right. Or little bits and bats. Not very often, so I don't badger anyone.
Okay.
Nothing worse than being badgered.
Well, we're not badgering people, are we?
No.
If my hair grew back, I might look like a badger. But Dickie Davis. Part spook Dickie Davis. Your beard's like a badger.
It is.
Yeah.
Do you know when my nipple were born 6 years ago, it was jet black.
Right. Yeah. Lack of sleep, stress, constant worry.
I've lost it. Nagging. Gone grayer and lost hair since you were born.
Yeah. What about your nostril hair?
That's
like
great.
A bunch of flowers, wasn't it?
It's growing fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Like a privet edge. Thanks for everybody ordering vitamin C powder and all the other goodies on the Health Bunker website. Remember, use the promo code for all Health Bunker products. It's not available on products that aren't Health Bunker. There's one Health Bunker product where you get 10% off, not 25%, but we try and keep the discounts flowing. And the more people from outside the Sheep Farm crew that order, i.e. people in the general public, hopefully, in the longer term, I can offer more discounts. They're discounting your prices. there you go. This week...
Cash-making shill.
Yeah. We're grifters now, apparently, Chris. Grifters.
Yeah. Called us grifters.
So we've got bullshit platform, big shill mics. Now we're I'm not going into called as grifters selling stuff. I guess this week's a grifter as well.
Mark's definitely a grifter.
Yeah. Lance and Andy are grifters.
Oh, don't even get me started on them.
They're rally grifters.
So while we're talking about grifters, we might as well mention the merch shop and the £2 membership for the second hour.
Yeah, I don't like that. I might edit that
way. Well, the merch shop, I put on the... did I mention it last week? I put on a thick as mince t-shirt.
Right.
Yeah, I did mention it last week.
I'm sure somebody else used that phrase. Yeah. Won't go into that either.
It's good drawing as well. I actually got some pictures of some mints.
We get some names called us, don't we? You know, I if I were really sensitive, I could sue these people. You know, grifters, shills, bullshit platform, thick as mince.
We get more positive than negative.
I know, but you could really if you were a woke snowflake.
If you were in some sort of lawsuit. If you were Jeremy Vine.
Yeah, if you were Jeremy Vine. Oh, Jeremy. Somebody called him a name.
What was his name?
Yeah, somebody called him a terrible name.
I didn't say it, I'm actually was.
Well, no, he can't now because it's out in public domain. Someone called him a bike nonce, so he sued
him. Call him a bike nonce. So you can now call Jeremy bike.
No, you can't call him it, but you can say somebody called him a bike nonce.
Oh, right, yeah, they did. Yeah. Someone called him a bike nonce.
Yeah.
Why? Because he's a bike nonce.
No, he ain't a bike nonce. He sued him and won. So he's proved he ain't a bike nonce.
Right.
But in court, the court case was about him being called a bike nonce.
Right.
And he proved he wasn't a bike nonce by suing. And then the week after, he wore ladies' shoes at work.
Did he?
Yeah.
Is that true?
That's true. I've got a picture of it, a video of him walking up and down. It were in all major papers. I like to see him riding his bike in them. He's one of them people who rides his bike around just looking for trouble, isn't he?
Yeah, with a camera on him. Yeah.
He's looking for somebody who's cut him up or might have cut him up or so he can sue them.
Yeah, commonly known as a bank nonce.
Might be a court nonce. might get a fetish of wearing women's shoes and taking people to court.
I've swore at quite a lot of people on my bike over the years. I've also been knocked off it by a taxi. Just turned straight into me. But yeah. I'm a cyclist and a driver, so I understand both sides. But when you get the new students,
so you're a bike nonsense.
Well, I'm not like mammaled up or anything. I'm just right. I just ride to work.
Mammal, I like that one.
Yeah, I do as well. Middle-aged men in Lycra.
Yeah,
but I understand both sides. But one thing I will say, when the new students come here, fucking hell, you should see him. He's terrifying when you're in a car and they're just zigzagging. It's like they've never ridden a bike before.
Yeah, but down in Cambridge, they ride those stupid Harry Potter bikes and all, don't they? Yeah,
but they don't look over the shoulder for it. You can tell they've never ridden.
They've got the long coats behind them, trailing behind them.
Got a new bike and they've never ridden. Yeah. They're like shaking down a main road and you're like, oh, God.
You know, with metal brakes.
Yeah.
Terrifying. Squeak. That's all the bike. They don't ride modern bikes, just them stupid bikes, don't they?
My missus has got one of them.
They weigh about 3 tons.
Dutch bike. Yeah,
is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Twat bike, I call them.
We've got like 5 bikes.
I wonder if I'm going to get sued by a load of Cambridge students for calling them twat bikes.
Yeah, it is a cycle town.
A cycle town, yes. Cycle paths, yeah. Yeah, so we got Mark on. The image I'm going to use for this is the one that you drew about...
The Stanley Kubrick one.
Yeah.
Yeah. The 2001 Space Odyssey one.
With the monkeys, you put an Apple iPhone on it, didn't you?
Yeah, touching that megalith. I don't know if that was my original thought, that fire, or someone else. I don't even know anyone else has ever done that. But I think, like Mark said in this, it could be a TV, it could be a photo, it could be anything, couldn't it? But it does make sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, we do talk a bit about Kubrick. I mean, we talked a bit about when Trevor were on last week, were it? I lose track now about what I think we are on 2004 One Space Oddity podcast.
Yeah.
but yeah, we talked a bit about Kubrick in this one because Mark's just done that new film.
Mm. Yeah, on Amazon. What's it called? We mentioned it in this anyway, don't we?
Your Clockwork Shining.
Clockwork Shining, that's it.
Yeah. So, and it, obviously, we talk about his new upcoming books that he's looking at doing, but all sorts of other stuff. We rambled on about many different
things. Mark, he's definitely a shill. He's on Amazon now.
Ah! Mark, you need to get
signed, sealed, and delivered.
Yeah. It's signed, sealed, and delivered with his big shill mic. Yeah.
An Amazon publication.
Yeah. Even though everybody publishes books on Amazon. I forget about that one. We've got to use what tools we can, I suppose, haven't we?
We have.
And speaking of tools, not else to say, Chris?
No.
All right, then. Yeah. We hope you enjoy this chat we have with Mark. If you're going to join us in part two, we'll see you there. Part two is available at sheepfarm.co.uk. Bye.
Yep. Bye.
All right. Welcome back to Sheep Farm Podcasts. This is episode 204. I'm getting mixed up now because we cocked up on the numbers of the week. Keep saying that. We said 2002 or something like that. But anyway, there you go. Tonight, we're joined by our mate, who's not really a guest anymore, I suppose, Mark Devlin, joining me and Chris. Chris, you got a bottle of witch piss ready?
Good evening, Mark. I've got one here, yeah. I've got one ready. It's a bit early yet, though.
Be rude not to.
Yeah.
Hello, lads.
Hiya, mate. Yeah, you're all right. Have you got a bottle of witch piss, Mark, or can of Tizer or something?
No, I normally have a can of Stella on the go, but I'm having a night off tonight, giving my liver a break.
Yeah. I do that occasionally, believe it or not.
Just the one night, mind.
Yeah. Christian does that occasionally. It's normally like from 9 o'clock till 7 o'clock or something like that. That's what he gives him.
Every second Thursday after a full moon.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah.
Only on a leap year.
Yeah. Well, I hope you've got all you two's got your big shill mics tuned in to this bullshit platform. You've just had an upgrade on your shill mic, haven't you, Mark?
Yeah, I've got my Olympic torch, as you put it. Grip
Yeah.
so tight, my knuckles are popping out of my skin.
I mentioned that when we met you, didn't I? And I was right, wasn't I? When I said you were gripping that mic. I think you told me to flick it,
Yeah,
Pepe.
all the paint's worn off the mic. It
Before we
actually
got
has.
chatting to you, I had that conversation with Dom. Have you seen how white his knuckles are? I think he's gripping that with pure tension.
I think that we're after we listened to that Boris Johnson one when he called him
Through the
a
initial
fat
convid, wasn't
Italian twat.
it? I think it's when I was doing my God videos that would do
Yeah.
it.
Yeah.
It was your car ranting around that period of time, then,
Yeah,
when
that too.
you were. I think there's an excuse for my anger at that particular point.
I was going to say
Righteous
as
anger.
well. I was going to say as well. I mean, I have a glass of witch piss, Matt, as a can of Stella. In this shit show, I'm surprised we're not all crackheads.
Yeah.
Making Mark Passio seem like a well-balanced, calm individual.
Yeah. Interestingly, my missus, because you're not using the camera tonight, and he said to me, are we doing video? And I said no. I said that's good. My wife, we're watching Bodybuilder, Chris. We were having a laugh the other week about you painting crackheads
You're watching
knackers,
all the
and I'm watching
bodybuilders.
all the body. And she said, yeah, he were hosting something, and she said, yeah, he's got really good physique, and I think she was looking at other stuff and face for YouTube. And I said, What about me and Chris then with podcasting? She said, yeah, you two's got faces for radio.
Very nice. Thanks.
Yeah, it's
Thanks,
nice, that,
Nick.
isn't it? Yeah.
Well, me too, which is why
Yeah.
the camera's not
Yeah.
on.
Christian's got nostrils for radio.
Yeah,
To get that one in right now.
thanks for that.
Yeah. What I would say, we do formulate quite a lot of emails pass between us, don't we? Me, you, normally, and Matt Sergio, Mark.
Yeah, about 12 a day. I read them, but I generally don't get involved.
Yeah.
No, I've noticed that.
You tend to send stuff, Chris, and that sparks something
Yeah,
else,
I
though.
enjoy doing that. Yeah, that's quite good fun.
And then Matt writes a thesis on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just goes on and on, doesn't it?
Yeah. Then
Does.
I do a genealogy link list. That's getting interesting, that Jane Asher one. It's getting very interesting, is that one.
And it always involves Charlemagne, have you noticed?
Yeah.
That
Always
dude
goes
was
back to,
busy.
he was busy. He had some overactive nads.
He sure did.
Yeah, I don't know how many wives either, but yeah,
Second
Charlemagne.
only to Adam.
Yeah. It must have been like the Lionel Richie of his day.
Theophilus P. Wildebeest.
Yeah, but I was thinking, we could act. There could actually be a series of shows with just those emails alone. If I bullet pointed them over the last couple of years, there's actually a show there, isn't there?
Well, there's a book there.
Yeah, probably is. Yeah, it'd be an interesting look anyway. It'd probably take me a month to put together, but I might do that at some point. Pull out some interesting ones. So, talking of books, you've got a couple of new releases coming up.
Oh, nice segue.
Yeah, could be professional. We could be actually trained at
Almost
the
planned.
yeah, the almost planned at the
Well,
Big Shill My Bullshit Platform training school.
you
So.
saying?
Yeah, well, what the books that are coming out, that's what we're going to talk about. The
Books,
segue.
okay.
Yeah.
All right, segue, yeah. So the next book I'll be putting out is actually my first book, which is kind of a forgotten work, which not a lot of people know about. So long before I got on this musical truth path, and before I realized that the world is run by psychopaths and Satanists, I was actually having quite a bit of fun. Imagine that, quite enjoying life and
What's that again?
traveling around as a DJ and doing parties and gigs and stuff. And I thought that's all life consisted of. How naive was I? But I actually wrote a book about it. So it was called Tales from the Flip Side. And I had the idea of bringing together a collection of anecdotes and funny stories from the sharp end of the DJ world. And so I wrote it across 2005 and 2006. And I self-published it through a company called Author House. This is before Amazon CreateSpace was around. So you had to go through companies like this. And I put it out in January 2007. So I had the idea of releasing an 18th anniversary edition of it. Just coming up, and I thought I would write a new foreword and a bunch of new footnotes throughout. And what I thought would be interesting would be for people to get a glimpse into what my mindset was like at that time, long before any kind of an awakening, to use that term, or a realization that the world is not quite the way we've been raised to think of it as. So I'm putting this book out really soon. I'm hoping to get it out by the end of November, actually, on Amazon. Or if I miss that, it will be early December. And it's the original text from the book. So it's me just talking about my value system at the time, which, as I say, was parties, gigs, tunes, chasing women, not having much success, that sort of thing, with new footnotes. So, yeah, I think a lot of people are unfamiliar with that book and have no idea that I ever wrote it because I've never really promoted it before. It's not on Amazon yet, but it will be soon. So that's the plan.
I've heard you mention it actually a few times. Are your footnotes going to be with your modern day mindset?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so the footnotes are at the base of each page, and it's where I pick up on a comment that I made back in the day, 18 years ago, and just add some new perspective to it and talk about how I see things now. So, for example, I'm bigging up my DJ heroes of the time, like Pete Tong and Tim Westwood. Imagine that. So, I mean, these days, if you mention Tim Westwood, you have to offer a disclaimer. There has to be a caveat. So there's plenty of those throughout.
Yeah, some disinfectant wash, I think, when you mention his name.
That's a good idea, though, Mike. It's a good idea. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, and I'm mentioning quite a few other DJs. It's funny because all the DJs that were my heroes back in the day, I'm now putting them on blast and exposing them in my modern books. So it's funny how things work out.
I would almost guess the ones that you had in the High Stakes theme and now
now in the sewer.
The biggest disappointments, yeah.
So Tales from the Flip Side has actually flipped back, I suppose.
Yeah. Or flipped, Satanic Inversion. Flipped again.
Yeah, Satanic Inversion, yeah. So you've got a second book. It was going to be part four, I believe, of Musical Truth, wasn't it? But it's not
well,
now.
Yeah, it still is. It's still part of the Musical Truth series.
Yeah.
But I did say when I put out Musical Truth Volume 3, I said, well, that's the trilogy. It was always intended to be a trilogy. So I didn't want to do Musical Truth 4, Musical Truth 5, because I could see myself getting to Musical Truth 176 if I live that long, which I seriously doubt. So I just wanted to kind of cap that series there. But there was still clearly more to say and more points to put across. The research never ends, as you well know. And I feel that this information needs to get out there. And I already have a platform. I already have an audience. So I think I need to continue putting this stuff out. But I was originally going to call it Musical Truth Soundbites because I thought it was going to be a collection of short stories and anecdotes that reinforce the points made in the earlier volumes. But I've since decided on the title No One's Dad's a Plumber, because I think it's quite catchy and I think it makes the point, because as we've discussed many times over, when it comes to musicians or celebrities or famous people of any description, you have no problem finding generals, admirals, aristocrats, university lecturers, politicians, Lord Mayors, foreign diplomats, this sort of thing. But plumbers, builders and lorry drivers are in fairly short supply.
A bit thin on the ground, aren't they, when it comes
to really are.
Celebrities?
But I'm starting with a really shocking story. So I've already written a fair chunk of the book. I've done all the DJ chapters. So I've you know, destroyed all my previous DJ heroes and, you know, shown them for their true colours, who they really are. But I'm writing some other sections of the book as well. And I'm starting off with a really shocking story, which is I have found a famous musician whose dad was a plumber. Can you believe it?
I did find an actor. I'm trying to think who it was. Was it Kenneth Branagh? I did find an actor. Yeah,
there was someone I remember. Yeah,
he were a plumber and he installed ceilings, didn't he?
False ceilings.
Yeah, Kenneth Branagh's dad. I think it was Kenneth Branagh.
Well, the one I found was Marquis Smith,
right?
Out of Manchester,
and he was actually Super Mario.
Yeah,
a plumber.
Yeah, so he was. His dad was. But it turns out his granddad, was it his granddad or his great-grandfather, fought in the Boer War. there is a military sort of history to his family when you go back a few generations. But his first-generation dad was a plumber, so we'll go with that. It's as good as it gets.
Dave McGowan's got a lot to answer for, bless him.
He has.
With this type of research. Yeah, what did he start? Started your work, certainly influenced mine. And many, many others.
I think he had no idea, actually, what he stumbled onto. And the interesting thing about his work is that he was taking stuff that was already in the public domain. So it was information that had been out there for years in newspaper articles and obituaries and books. And he was consolidating it and aggregating it, bringing it all together and showing how the patterns and the trends emerged and cross-correlating stuff. And it's a style of research that anyone could have done at any time, but for whatever reason, they hadn't. So Dave was that guy who stepped up and did that research. And I don't think he fully appreciated the value of what he was bringing to the world. I think he thought it was a curiosity and it was a quite an interesting thing looking at where all these musicians' dads came from. But I think he would have had no idea what he would have started in terms of snowballed. Inspiring guys like us to do the work.
Snowballed since he died, Mark, didn't it? It snowballed massively. His research.
Oh, yeah. Nearly 10 years now.
I remember in the heady days of YouTube being decent, when I remember listening to all his interviews on YouTube.
Yeah.
When he was promoting Program to Kill and then
Laurel Canyon.
Laurel Canyon one, yeah.
I did a show with him in 2014 and he nearly didn't come on because he really took a strong disagreement to my stance on the Paul is Dead McCartney situation. So Dave was a big Beatles fan and he hadn't realized what my stance was on the idea of McCartney being replaced. And at the time he had a Facebook chat page, and he had a big fan base that had read his book, and all these people would get on there and comment with each other and stuff. And Dave had posted, "Oh, I'm going on this English dude Mark Devlin show to talk about my Laurel Canyon work." And somebody had said in the thread, "Dave, you do realise that he adheres to the Paul is Dead rumour, don't you?" And then McGowan was like, "Oh, well, fuck that. Then I might not do it. Maybe I shouldn't do it." So I had to get on to him and say, no, please come on, Dave. We don't have to talk about that. But, you know, I don't not do the show just because of that.
I wonder if it had changed his opinion by now with all the extra research that people have done.
Well, he'd be in a minority if he hadn't.
Yeah, he's quite hard to deny it anymore, isn't it, I think?
Even to the point where, whether you really think that he died or he didn't die, that there weren't people that looked like him.
And there's something very, very fishy going on in that whole story. I heard something interesting the other day, and this is not my idea, and I can't remember where I heard it now. But they said, you know, the whole thing when the Beatles came out and the Monkees came out at the same time, maybe the Monkees were used because they were known to be in a put together band. To take away the fact that the Beatles could also possibly have been a manufactured band, if you know what I mean, to take that away from that.
So they
idea.
Look better.
A bit so like the manufactured band.
These a bit like Gary Barlow's the best singer.
Yeah.
Well, they were out of Laurel Canyon, the Monkees.
Yeah. Yeah, they came straight out of there, didn't they? Yeah. I'm just rereading Laurel Canyon, actually. Probably the third time I've gone through it. And every time you go through it, you find something new, especially when you're researching stuff yourself, you can link it back to some of the things that you've done. So even his work after you've reread the book comes together and sets you off in another. It's like when he did the Jim Morrison research. I found out that he actually had another uncle who was even higher up in the Navy. He was even so he was a full blown admiral, and he's buried at Bloody Arlington Cemetery. So even his research that he set going in motion, there's actually probably more research behind it. It's even more frightening than that, I think.
Just makes you wonder, if he'd never done that research and put that book out, would somebody else have stepped up and done it? Or would we all be sat here all these years later, none the wiser for any of this stuff?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Again, as we talk, we're probably going to talk about the coding in The Matrix. Is that what, you know, are we witnessing that if he didn't do it, that's part of this matrix that it had to happen at that, around that point, if you like, because without the internet, he probably wouldn't have been able to do it.
I think
that's a whole different story.
Mm. I think if I'm right, mate, he wrote Laurel Canyon from basically a web page where he was getting people send him information.
That's right.
Was that right? Yeah.
Yeah, it was a bunch of articles on a web page. And then he decided to weave them together into a book. Mm. And I think at the time he was releasing them article by article. And he was coming across this research. He was like, "Oh, this is a strange thing. Jim Morrison's father was the Navy Admiral in the Gulf of Tonkin." And then it would be like, "Oh, well, look, Frank Zappa's father was into military intelligence as well. And he was into biological warfare." And then it was like, bloody hell, John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas as well. And then it was every single artist, everyone you could look at from that community had those same kind of connections. So Dave was kind of discovering that stuff as he went. And he was like, this is amazing. It just never ends.
Yeah. Yeah. And it weren't the fact that their parents had been in the military. It was the fact that they were all like intelligence operatives or high up in the military. It weren't like they were just normal grunts, were they?
Well, this is an objection you quite often get from people. So I've had this before at my talks when I've presented information of this nature. People will say, you're talking about the post-World War II years. Yeah. Of course, people's parents would have been in the army. And yes, they would because they had the draft. But we're talking high-ranking individuals, like you say, lieutenant colonels and generals and admirals. And another thing I get, another objection, you probably get this as well, is, oh, if you go back far enough in anyone's family tree, you'll find Shalmania or one of the English kings.
Yeah.
You know, you can say, oh, Taylor Swift's descended from King Richard the First or whatever it is. And people will say, oh, everyone is. You've just got to trace it back far enough. Well, I don't know if that's true because I can go back four generations on my mother's side and all you find is country peasants. So I'm still waiting for an aristocrat to pop up there.
You were explaining this to me, don't we, earlier?
Yeah. Possibly a plumber's an upgrade. In our,
it would be, it'd be Wattle and Daub back in there.
Well, I actually look at it as somebody emailed us the other day with some really good questions, similar, not questions like that, saying about the George Orwell. I look at a common ancestor, a direct line back, not a cousin of a cousin of a cousin, which you could say there's still a relation or a bloodline, but a direct ancestor back to that royal family, if you like. So when we were doing the Jane Asher thing, there was a common ancestor that George Orwell and Jane Asher share is Thomas Fane, the Duke of Westmoreland. And then that goes straight back. So there, he's a great, 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 great granddad. So that's a direct bloodline. Mm. It's not a distant cousin. It's not someone who might know someone or someone who lived next door to someone. It's a direct bloodline that straight back to Edward III. That is a direct bloodline.
That's different, isn't it?
Yeah. That's totally different, that. Yeah. It's not a third cousin or a fifth cousin. And even that can be a direct bloodline. But so going back, those arguments don't really stack up because people say, well, you know, such and such a king could have a million or 2 billion ancestors now that he's, you know, given birth to since he were died in 20 generations. But that doesn't stack up if we've got a direct line back to that person. That's different, is that?
It's funny, actually, I'm saying that. I remember going back some years watching a documentary on normal TV, and the whole thing was about how we're only a few generations from being related. Mm. And we're thinking about it now. That was probably put out there for a reason.
Well, none of these people, none of them advertised the fact that you sent some over the other day, didn't you, Mark, about someone being a cousin? I forget who it was now. None of them advertised the fact. It just comes out.
What about the one you found with, what's his
Which
name?
Which one?
the English actor who played the secret agent, the code breaker. And it turned out he was actually
Benedict Cumberbatch was Alan Turing's cousin.
Yeah. But he never mentioned, why not mention it when you're promoting the film?
He were actually playing him. He played him.
Yeah, I know he did. But what I mean is, why not mention it when they're promoting the film, going around, spending all that money? He knew that.
Well, that film was a good few years ago. What I'm finding now is,
and it was about
code damage limitation.
Yeah.
I think you've got people like Janet Jackson did an interview the other week and she said, oh, I'm cousins with Samuel L. Jackson and Stevie Wonder. So she just comes out with it as if it's nothing, it's nothing special, nothing unusual, you know, it's nothing to it, folks, nothing to see here. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of this going on now because it's damage limitation. And I think it's because of the impact that guys like us are having in showing how all these famous people are connected and who they're descended from. It's not nothing. It is important, but they want to make it seem like it's trivial and, you know, there's nothing special
just
about
normal.
What we're doing.
Yeah. But that'd be like going to work. Let's say you work in an office and there's 20, 30, 40, 50 people there, and you've been related to all of them, if that's true.
Right.
A direct line relation to
every other plumber in town is your cousin.
Yeah. Now, that might be the truth in some local areas, but...
Well, it depends where you live. I mean, have you been round here lately?
Yeah.
Everyone's got three thumbs.
It's when everybody... My wife saw somebody walking down the road in the village, so it's coming to a village now near you. He had bright blue hair like an hydrangea, or she had, with bright blue shoes on, She didn't know whether it were a boy or a girl.
Near where you live, Fat?
Yeah, near where we live, in the middle of nowhere.
You live in the middle of nowhere.
So it might be friendly with some of the sheep. So does P. Diddy make an appearance, Mark, in this plumber's book?
P. Diddly, P. Dodie. Yeah, he gets a mention. It'd be rude not to, really, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been on his case since about the mid-90s. Mm. So it's not news. You know, anyone that's moved in sort of R&B, hip-hop, urban music circles is not in the least surprised about any of this stuff that's coming out about P. Diddy. Mm. I mean, the scale of it, possibly, but the nature of it, no, because there were stories about him in the mid-90s circulating. So in my second book, I think
it was the second one, wasn't it?
Volume two. I've got a section on Puffy there, talking about how he screwed all his artists over and exploited them financially. Not talking about the freak-offs and such, because we didn't have that much information back then, but it's been long known that he's a wrong-un, very dodgy individual, not the luckiest individual to be around. And it's good to see chickens coming home to roost there, finally, it would appear.
Do you think he could be responsible, him and the Epstein stuff, for the silence during COVID from famous folk, Matt?
Well, for sure. He's been described as the Jeffrey Epstein of hip-hop. And them two, I'm sure...
Combined covers everybody, doesn't it? Covers politicians, business folk.
Pretty much, because Diddy was having famous actors and sports people and even royals, we hear, attending his parties at his various mansions. It was all getting filmed. It would have been used for leverage and blackmail and keeping people in line. There'll be quite a lot of people cancelling the laxative order, I would imagine, at the moment.
Not a nice thought.
No, that is a David Icke phrase, actually.
But, yeah,
it does fit the bill.
Who is it? I heard something, Justin Bieber actually talks about his freak-off parties, doesn't it? In one of his songs. Is that true? Or was it made up? I'm sure I read that somewhere.
I don't recall him mentioning it in a song, but I might have missed that.
I heard a song somewhere. It might have been on Instagram, so I weren't sure if it was real or not. It was someone quoting his lyrics about mentioning how he changed his life going to his pie, but it might not be true because I didn't look into it, Max.
There's some strange videos knocking about. I put some on the videos that I make, knocked together, the Matrix videos. But I don't even like the guy, Puff Daddy. I don't even like...
He's a creepy just looking
odd fucker, looking
isn't
face. Not because since all this came out, just... I never liked his music. He never seemed sincere or anything like that. It just didn't.
Never done it for me.
Something about him
you can
up.
Trust.
Yeah.
That's why he'd always wear dark glasses.
Yeah, he's famous and you know who he is, but I can't even name his songs or I don't know anything about him, to be honest with you.
Well, it makes me laugh because whenever you see a headline about him now, it's like rapper Puff Daddy or rap mogul Sean Combs. He was never any rapper. His rap lines consist of, yeah, that's right, bad boy, bitch. take that. And that's it.
He was just a producer, wasn't he?
Well, not even a producer. He was an executive producer. So he'd go in the studio and he'd have an engineer who'd do all the work in putting the recording together. And he'd just say, use this sample, tweak that a bit, put this rapper here. He wouldn't actually get busy on the boards himself. He had no technical skills. So, you know, you've got to ask yourself, what skills did he have? Because...
Operative.
Yeah.
I remember reading in your book, Mark, about how he shafted everyone he worked with, didn't he? Got people with talent, shafted them and just pillaged them, basically.
Yeah. I was watching a video the other day with Shine, who's this rapper that used to be signed to his Bad Boy Records label. And there was this shooting incident in a nightclub in New York in 1999 where Diddy was there with J-Lo, who was supposedly his girlfriend at the time, although I hear his preferences lie elsewhere. Beard, you might say, trophy girlfriend. And there was this incident where a gun went off in the club and the police gave chase to Diddy's car afterwards and all the evidence seems to point to Diddy allegedly having fired the gun and somebody was injured. And as the police gave chase after his car, a gun was thrown from the window. And afterwards, Shine took the rap for that event and he went to jail 10 years. And it seems fairly clear that Diddy paid him off, probably quite a generous sum, to go and do that bid for him so he could stay out of jail. And for some reason, Shine, many years after he got out, he became a rabbi, actually, converted to the Jewish faith. This is the thing about anyone that's ever worked with Diddy. They either become a drug addict, they're dead, or they turn to religion. What does that tell you about the time they've spent with him? You know, yeah. Mace became a Christian minister. Shine became a rabbi. Anyway, in 2021, Shine performed on stage with Puffy, Diddy, at the BET Awards or a show of that nature. And I saw Shine being interviewed the other day, and the interviewer was like, why did you appear on stage with Diddy? And he said, I had my reasons for doing that. And she said, he called you his brother. And then Shine says, yeah, was he my brother when I went to jail for 10 years back in 2000?
Oh, God.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Matt, a bit cheesed off about that one.
Open admission there.
Yeah. Yep. So, Chris, you watched A Clockwork Shine, didn't you?
I've watched half of it. I haven't watched all of it yet. But I was listening to Mark's interview with Jay Widener and the director today. And then I'm going to watch the other half. I couldn't watch it in my shed. The interview was really good, Mark.
Just watch the stuff in his shed, Mark.
Well, I listen to podcasts in my shed.
While he's painting teeth.
Listen to podcasts in my shed.
Tell them what teeth you're painting, Chris, because I've obviously said you're just painting teeth. They might think you're just painting teeth.
No, I'm painting my weird sculptures that I make. I'm painting the teeth on the weird sculptures. But I'm like a pig in shit in there, to be fair. Nice cup of coffee, put a podcast on, and just sit painting sculptures for about 6 hours till I pick my nipper up from school.
Isn't it a bit cold down there this time of year?
Got two heaters in there, Matt.
Okay.
It's Cambridge, Mark. You Southern Shandy Swillers. Up anyway, here, it's -4 today.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I put on my T-shirt, especially my Apollo 11 USA Danny T-shirt from The Shining. But that angle that they give on that, it's fantastic, isn't it? The MK Ultra Shining angle. Never heard that before. I mean,
yeah, it really is. I think The Shining is probably the most analysed film in movie history. Yeah. You go on YouTube and you can just go on for hours going through videos that people have made with their own interpretation of the hidden meanings that Kubrick coded into that film. And Jay Widener himself has done previous videos. Kubrick's Odyssey is a series he's got. He took part in this documentary called Room 237 years ago, which is where four separate analysts give their view on what Kubrick was trying to express through that movie. So you've got to strip away the surface narrative. The surface narrative tells you that it's about this guy who takes on the job of a winter caretaker at this remote hotel, and the solitude and the cabin fever drives him into this murderous rage where he goes after his family and tries to kill him with an axe.
Nice.
That's the exoteric view of what that movie is about. And that's the way it was sold to mainstream audiences.
Sorry to stop you. That actually sounds like one of them guys that Keir Starmer let off. Isn't he chasing somebody around with an axe? Anyway.
Weekend at Diddy's.
Yeah.
I do agree with what Jay said in that interview, though, that all those different four different things in the Shining are all possible. And then now he's found another one.
That's the genius of Kubrick, that he could actually encode all these different things.
And
you haven't just got one hidden element, you've got several.
And I've watched that film. It was one of them I had on a VHS when I was about 15 and watched it. You know, one of them just stuck on and watched over and over and over again. And I didn't notice any of this stuff, obviously. I just saw the surface level. But you always knew there was something more to it, didn't you? You could feel there was something. Everything meant something in that
because
film.
It was changed so much from the Stephen King novel, and Stephen King famously hated it, and he didn't get on with Kubrick at all. They disagreed and didn't see eye to eye because Kubrick had just altered his script so much. And according to Jay, which I didn't realize till I watched A Clockwork Shining back, Jay Widener knows a lot about Stanley Kubrick. He said that Warner Brothers, the studio that Stanley worked for, basically forced him to take The Shining. They said, we want you to make this book into a movie. And Stanley didn't want to do it, but it was in his contract or something that he had to do this movie. So Stanley thought, okay, how can I make this thing more interesting? How can I get my own messages into this? Well, the first thing to do is to completely rip apart the Stephen King narrative and put my own elements into it. And in A Clockwork Shining, they talk about how Stanley had knowledge of the MK Ultra mind control program coming out of the CIA due to his military intelligence links. And so he coded a lot of that stuff in layered elements of that movie. But there was other stuff going on as well. And I love the comment from Ryder Lee, who's the guy that had the idea for doing the documentary, and he approached Jay Widener about putting it out there. And Ryder says, The Shining is considered one of the greatest horror movies ever made. But is it really a horror movie? And so if you take things from Kubrick's point of view, it's not a horror movie at all. I mean, only one person dies apart from Jack at the end. So it's not a very high body count. And according to those two guys, there are no ghosts or supernatural entities at all. It's all down to tricks of the mind. That's their take on it.
Yeah, brilliant. I was actually gobsmacked. I mean, how can a film, I mean, all these films that were all made, so even going back to Space Odyssey, the only one of his films I've not seen is Barry Lyndon. I've never seen that. But every one of them can be analysed and reanalysed right up to now. I even saw someone, a guy just doing a thing on YouTube, and he was talking about The Shining. And I never knew this, Matt. And like I said, I've watched that film dozens of times. And all the way through The Shining, he looks at the camera just for fleeting seconds. And he actually slowed it down. And I was like, at first, I was like, nonsense, it's not true. And he slowed down each scene. And loads of scenes all the way through the film, his eyes just flicker to the camera and then back again.
Yeah, I've seen that one.
I never noticed that, watching that
also
film.
Also, I've got a friend named Sean McCann over in the States who does a podcast called Waking the Dead. And he's a big-time Kubrick buff. He knows a lot about his films, and he's done loads of analysis into the hidden elements. And he emailed me today, and he was talking about how Stanley, with Eyes Wide Shut, his final film, placed a marker at the 1 and 2 hour points in the film. And so if you play the first hour, or if you start the first hour again at the beginning of hour two, you see that the scenes in each hour correspond and line up with each other in terms of messages, camera angles. And it's an absolute work of genius that this can have been achieved. But then he went further and he said, if you take four of Stanley's films, I think it was The Shining, A Clockwork Orange, Eyes Wide Shut, and Lolita, and you play them all at the same time, you start them all at the same point, then scenes in each of the films correspond with scenes in the other three films. So I've yet to watch the full video, but Sean McCann's posted that on his YouTube channel. And it sounds absolutely mind-blowing that
much
could be encoded. And for me, it goes way beyond the possibility that this could be down to just human planning. I mean, Stanley was a genius, yes, of course, but I still don't think one individual could sit down and intricately plan all this stuff to that degree without some kind of assistance from other forces, shall we say, in creation.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, bloody who knows, man.
Well, when he put into the mix, like we found out with Christopher Nolan's films, that he had, what do you call Nathan Crowley? Chris, I think he was called, wasn't he?
I get confused.
He's a definite relation of Aleister Crowley, and he's, I think, an Oscar-winning production designer. So you've got people like that. I'm not saying it was that guy, but there will be people around like that person within these film sets. You only need one person, don't you? Who's designing these film sets.
Well, I think as well, like you were saying about him going off, he basically isolated himself in that hotel. Cause I think it was a massive long shoot as well, wasn't it, Shining?
So yeah, it took ages. It started in 1978 and it was finally released in 1980, in time for Halloween 1980. Most of it was shot in England, Pinewood Studios.
How was it?
Stanley lived near there. He had a house near St. Albans, so he could be close to the film studios. He moved to England in the 1960s. I think it was after he produced 2001, A Space Odyssey. He moved away from America and lived in England for the rest of his life, and only went over to America when he had to. For some reason, he just didn't like being there. So most of that film was shot in England. Jack Nicholson and all the cast came over to film at Pinewood. And interestingly, another point they make in The Clockwork Shining is that they're talking about it being connected to MK Ultra. And there's a section where Joseph Atwill, the author and researcher, talks about the book A Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. And he makes the point that this is a well-known trigger in MK Ultra mind control programming, in the programming of Manchurian Candidate-style assassins. And I hadn't realized this until Jay Widener pointed it out. The Shining was released in late 1980, And then right at the end of 1980, you had the event where John Lennon was assassinated, we're told, by Mark David Chapman. I think there's more to that event than meets the eye. Mm. And it may not have actually been Chapman that pulled the trigger, but he was certainly programmed to believe that he'd done it. And he was discovered at the scene by cops after Lennon had been killed, reading a copy of Catcher in the Rye, just, you know, leafing through it and waiting for the cops to arrive, not making any attempt to escape. And then a couple of months after that, just as Ronald Reagan had been sworn in as US president with George W. Bush as his vice president, there was this attempt on Reagan's life where he was shot and he survived. But the guy that is said to have committed that one, John Hinckley Jr., was also caught reading a copy of Catcher in the Rye at the scene. So it seems fairly clear that that book was used as a mind control trigger. But the timing is also important. So if Ryder Lee and Jay Widener are correct in Stanley coding that into The Shining, that it was all about MKUltra, directly after that film was released, we have those two famous MKUltra incidents involving Manchurian candidates.
She's reading it in the film, isn't she, Mark? His wife.
Exactly. Shelley Duvall, yeah.
So at the start, she's reading a copy. Yeah. Yeah.
And Mark David Chapman and Hinckley Jr., both related to cousins of Matt Damon and Kevin Bacon. In fact, John Hinckley Jr. is a distant cousin of Reagan's wife, Nancy Reagan.
What's funny with that, Dom, is in that interview you did, Matt, they mentioned that they both look alike.
They do. If you look at Mark Chapman and John Hinckley Jr., they actually look alike. Mm. And also, they both look like Stephen King.
Yes,
as well.
I thought that as well, Mark. How mad's that?
I know, right?
They both got a Stephen King look to them, haven't they?
Yeah, glitches in the Matrix.
Yeah, or programming the Matrix, not glitches. Actually meant to happen.
Yeah,
it's. I mean, when you see all these links together, even going back, say, what those guys, their research, your research, and then you throw in the bloodline sort of stuff where they're all actually related to some the people they're actually trying to shoot sometimes. I mean, that's even more wild, isn't it?
Yeah. Just on the Chapman front, something I just meant to mention there. The movie Magical Mystery Tour from 1967, the Beatles, a trippy psychedelic film. There's a scene there where John Lennon is standing next to a poster, which is an advertisement for a coach company. And the slogan on the poster is "The best way to go is by MD&C. And it's been realised that 13 years later, John Lennon was killed by a man with the initials MDC, Mark David Chapman. So is that predictive programming, or is that this construct, the coding of it, arranging itself and causing events of this nature to happen? I know that's a separate conversation altogether, but yeah. It's
it just
one
seemed
that's
like
worth
that.
Throwing in there.
It just seemed like that a lot of the times, doesn't it? That pieces are just sliding together and it's not actually a plan of someone's.
Well, again, I would question whether that can be human planning or is it beyond that? Are we into
beyond human?
Beyond a bunch of guys sitting around a table planning this stuff out, you know?
Well, were we talking about in them emails, that biological AI were discussed?
Well, you know, anyway. Sorry, one thing I did always think about Kubrick that I found strange was, where did he get his brass from to make all these films? Because he notoriously went over budget, filmed for too long, and not all his films were massive hits. So, but then he got refinanced to do another one, and then another one. Barry Lyndon were a flop on it, and then he went on, and then he got The Shining. I mean, they all went on for Full Metal Jacket, looked like a decent budget. Space Odyssey must have been a massive budget. None of them look like small budgets, is what I'm saying.
Well, according to Jay Widener in his Kubrick's Odyssey series, Stanley had been hired by NASA and the American government to fake the footage of the moon landings.
Yeah.
You know, spoiler alert, folks, for anyone listening, but nobody's walked on the moon. You can't land a rocket on a luminary on a disc of light. You just can't.
They went back this year, though, didn't they, Matt? Oh, no, they didn't put it off till next year.
Apparently, there's volcanoes on there now. They just released a massive volcano erupted 200 million thousand years ago.
I don't know how long they can boot that down the road. every 2 years.
I'm sure when Elon Musk flies over in his new rocket Tesla, he'll tell us what's on the other side.
I think two things are going to happen. We're going to find a cure for cancer, And we're going to return to the moon in the same year. But don't hold your breath for either of those, folks. It's not advised. But anyway, according to Jay Widener, Stanley was hired to fake the moon landing footage because he'd done such a good job of the lunar surface, imagining the lunar surface in 2001 A Space Odyssey, that it was decided he was the man for the job. And so because he did that and he had that secret, so it was just, you know, something he had hanging over them, he was given carte blanche to make any movie that he wanted with an almost unlimited budget. So that would explain where he got the money to make things like Barry Lyndon, which was just a personal labor of love. Yeah. Apparently, Stanley wanted to make a costume drama. He was infatuated with that period of English history, and he just wanted to make a movie about it. And it lost a ton of money, but he was still allowed to come back and make more films after that. And if you imagine that he may have this hold over the establishment in terms of having produced that moon landing footage, it would explain why he was allowed to go on making these films.
And they've got a $70 million a day budget, so giving him a couple
NASA,
of giving him a bit of cash is not really going to affect anyone.
Yeah, crumbs from the table.
Now you say that, it does seem like he was just this artist in his own little playground, just doing whatever he wanted. It's just, that's what it seems like.
Well, it seems that way until we got to Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah,
and. Yeah. It seems, I was having this conversation with Jay Widener as well, it seems that Stanley just went too far with that one. He revealed too much. Mm. And Sean McCann, when he goes into his analysis of that film, believes there's a whole load of stuff being communicated there about how these so-called elites get down and what goes on at these parties, at these Rothschild mansions and such.
Well, we're seeing it with the P. Diddy stuff, aren't we, really?
Exactly. It's like Eyes Wide Shut times 100. Brick, in terms of what we're hearing.
I've watched Eyes Wide Shut a few times now, and the first
Eyes Wide Shut on baby oil.
First time I ever watched it, because again, like the Shining, on the surface, it explains everything, and by the end, it's like it's all in his head. He's just been paranoid, and then it's all over.
Yeah.
Then on second viewing and third viewing,
well, there was 20 odd minutes of footage that was cut from the final version of Eyes Wide Shut, which made the cinemas, and Stanley. Famously, whenever he had unused footage, he would just burn it. So there's no, don't expect to find that 20 minutes lying around on a cutting room floor anywhere, because it's just disposed of from what we hear. And that was the case with all Stanley's movies. So we can only wonder what was in the 20 odd minutes that didn't make the final cut of Eyes Wide Shut. And according to many researchers, they got rid of Stanley after that because they just felt that he was becoming a liability. He'd outlived his usefulness. And so he was offed.
And he always got a final edit, I think, if I've got that right.
Up until that one, yeah.
And then, yeah, died. Did he die just after it came out, just before it came out?
I think he died a week or so before it came out.
Mm.
And then immediately after he died, A Clockwork Orange was reissued.
I remember
so,
that.
So, yeah, that film was released in 1971. And it was another one which talked about state-sponsored mind control of the MK Ultra variety with a British slant to it. But there were a series of events which occurred in the wake of that film, violent events in the UK and beyond. And the media at the time were trying to lay the blame for it at the door of Stanley Kubrick and saying this nasty, repulsive film has caused these young people to go out and conduct these behaviours, mimicking the characters in the film. And we're told that Stanley was so dismayed at all of this that he himself personally chose to withdraw the movie from distribution and said he doesn't want it out there anymore. And almost immediately after he died, it was back on regular release all over the UK. I went to see it in 1999 for the first time, and it's all over the place. So Stanley's out of the way, and the film's back in circulation again.
And I mean, and that film... If you think of an image of MK Ultra, it's that film with his eyes pinned open.
Yeah.
And Andy McDowell's it with his eyes pinned open.
Malcolm McDowell. Yeah.
Malcolm McDowell, sorry. With his eyes pinned open, staring at that screen, watering. I mean, that is literally the image of MK Ultra that that you have in your head, isn't it?
Yeah. These days, you do that with the BBC Evening News.
Going back to Kubrick having a free reign, I mean, I'm not a film buff sounding like you two guys, but it seems to me that he was possibly utilised. And could have possibly been MK Ultra itself, because there's too many of his films that actually you can look. I mean, how many producers like that can you look into more or less every single film of theirs and see these? They're not even hidden messages, are they?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no one else. No one else like him, which is why his films are just so endlessly analysed. And there's probably stuff in Barry Lyndon that's waiting to be deciphered. Nobody bothers with Barry Lyndon because it's not his most exciting film.
Mm.
But yeah, there was nobody like Stanley. Reportedly, he was autistic, and autistic people are often geniuses. They produce masterpieces because their minds work in different ways to regular folk. So you often find some of the most amazing geniuses at their art are on the spectrum, basically.
Mm. One thing I did pick up on that, the MK Ultra Shining thing, was, you know, people have always talked about how the scenes don't continue and there's things missing from scenes. And if you imagine it's a load of people in the background of the hotel rushing around to put them all back, it makes sense, doesn't it, that things wouldn't get put back the way they were when Jack was last there, or is hallucinating on acid. And it tied a lot of things up. Because, like I said, I watched that film so many times. It made me really rethink that film. I'm going to watch it again soon, I think.
Yeah. I've seen it about 30 times myself. And with every new viewing, you spot something else that you missed last time.
I mean, even the end, when he's got the Baphomet and
the Baphomet, signals, as above, so below pose, yeah.
And that director pointed out that when one of the women's walked past, she's got a blood handprint on her dress. I'm like, what?
On her ass, yeah.
I never spotted that. Never even saw it.
Very subtle, isn't it, as well? These things. So subtle. But not subtle when you spot them. You think, out like you just said, Chris, how didn't I spot that?
But then all it means, all again, then it says is, what does that mean? It's just added more
intrigue.
To the fire. Yeah,
and
more
just
intrigue.
Imagine, if those continuity errors aren't errors at all, and it's Stanley's way of communicating something, he's risking his reputation by having people saying, oh, he's a sloppy director. He can't even get the bloody continuity right from one scene to the next. Mm-hmm. He knows that those scenes are supposed to be like that. Yeah. And he's risking people going around trashing him like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was upset. I mean, every bit of it in every film means something. So there's no way he was going to make continuity errors. No way. It doesn't make any sense, does it, from a character?
Exactly.
No.
I tried. I used him as inspiration for my two novels, actually, The Cause and the Cure and The Gift and the Curse. And I thought I'd really like to get layered elements in there. So you got the main surface narrative, and that's what the story appears to be. But for those that can read between the lines, there's all kinds of metaphors and allegories and stuff. And I actually used the movies of Stanley Kubrick as inspiration for that. And yeah, it's quite a difficult process, and you risk people not getting it. You know, there's always the chance that you, as the author, have put something in there that you want to communicate, but you don't know if readers are going to pick up on it. You just have to hope that they do. And it must have been the case with him. So Stanley was making these movies, and he didn't know that decades in the future, when we had this thing called the internet, there'd be people like Jay Widener and Sean McCann pulling these things apart and spotting all that stuff that he'd carefully layered into it. It was a risk for him.
But unless they knew at some point people would be, again, thinking that way. I'm not saying Kubrick himself, but the people behind the films knew that.
Well, I've always thought, Dom, because I did a picture for...
For whatever it means, yeah.
I did a picture for Sheep Farm of, you know, the monkeys around the obelisk, in 2001. It looks like an iPhone. I mean, is that a tablet that they're all worshipping? I mean, when the monkeys touch the tablet, they all change, become more violent, more intelligent, whatever you want to say. But it changes everything. And what it's the only thing that it looks like. I mean, I don't know if that's a common thought or not, but that's what it looks like to me. It looks like an iPhone.
Well, it does. Yeah. And another interpretation of that monolith, again, came from Jay Widener in one of his earlier films. Right. He noted that the dimensions of the monolith are identical to the dimensions of a cinema screen. So where you've got the primitive apes being affected by this monolith and it's changing their behaviours, and then every time the monolith appears, there's like this leap in human consciousness. What that's actually saying is that the monolith is a mirror. It's the cinema screen. And the audience looking at the monolith are the ones being affected by it because you're being affected by the film, which I thought was a very clever.
Yeah.
You could say it's a cinema screen that then becomes a widescreen TV that then went on to become a tablet stroke Black Mirror device.
Exactly.
Bloody hell.
Talking of the construct, you've been doing talks. We've been doing a couple of podcasts with our mate Mark Bajerski on synchronicities. You're doing a talk, or you've done one on synchronicities, I think. Am I right there?
Yeah. I did one on Saturday in Stroud.
Right.
Synchronicities and the Power of the Subconscious Mind.
Yeah.
So this is a talk that I first presented a couple of years ago. And the one that I did on Saturday was a slightly updated version because I've got a bit of a different take these days on what synchronicities actually are to what I used to. Mm. So I presented some new information and it's not for everyone, but it is what it is.
Well, I think that's the journey, isn't it? The journey is finding out this information, getting slapped around the face with wet fish moments and realizing that you were wrong and having to backtrack a little bit and go forward again. And synchronicities, I mean, I don't know how you guys, but for me, that it seems to be that it can be anything but a coincidence. That I run a scenario. I was driving in my car. I turned the radio on and there was some cricket on in the summer. And they were talking about a cricketer called Mitchell Stark, right? So it's not a normal name, that. A van takes over me and it's an electrician's van called Stark Electrical.
Yep.
Right? That cannot possibly be random. Now, what it means, I don't know. It shows you that there are only so many, like, notes, musical notes, there are only so many things playing out in this construct screensaver that we're living in.
I was in the Mr. Upstairs the other day. I was boring with my Instagram video I did from sculptures. And I put the Nina Simone song, Baltimore, behind it. And I just showed it and that was it. And then she said, can you hear that? And the radio was on downstairs. And it was on Radio 6, I think. And they were playing Baltimore by Nina Simone, like 10 seconds after. And it's a pretty obscure song, isn't it? And Radio 6 don't usually play things like that. And it was within 10 seconds. And she said, I thought it was coming from your computer, but it's on downstairs at the same time.
And Dom, I got a story almost identical to yours. So I was due to have a chat with Nathan Lucius, you had on last week.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about what I was going to ask him in this podcast. And just as I was thinking about this, I was driving and this van overtook and there's his name on the van at that moment. So who's going to say, first of all, that's a coincidence? Or secondly, you manifest it. I mean, a lot of people will say that you manifest it into your own experience. But, you know, I've got a different view these days on why that sort of thing happens.
What's that?
Would you like to hear it?
Yeah, of course I would, yeah.
So in my so-called God videos, which have got me into a lot of trouble with certain communities, but equally I've got a lot of support from many people.
I think you should be whipping yourself with nettles every day.
A lot of people think I should be, and a lot worse, I think.
It's funny how upset people can get about a conversation.
Well, they can. And all I'm really doing is asking questions, but I'm starting to formulate some ideas as to why these things do happen. So I've come to the realization, as far as I'm concerned, that this realm of existence in which we find ourselves is very akin to a virtual reality computer game. So you hear lots of talk these days about this being a simulation or a sort of matrix construct. And I think those are all accurate terms to describe what we're dealing with here. I think it's coded in the way a piece of computer software is coded. So whatever force or entity created this realm, I personally don't accept that it's the original God of creation. I'm far more aligned to the idea that it's some sort of lesser God or demiurge or some sort of demonic entity that created this place. As I say, not a popular view. But I think it was created in the same way that, you know, a computer game would have been. And so everything is coded and there are rules written into the coding. There are parameters. You can't go beyond the parameters. But the reason we have things like meaningful coincidences or synchronicities is simply because the base coding of this construct, of this realm, is arranging itself in certain ways. So you often hear people speaking of energy, frequency, and vibration. And I think those are valid. It's definitely a good way of explaining why things happen. But you can go beyond that to the actual base core of things. And it's all to do with coding. So when you're thinking about a particular individual, you're exuding energetic vibrations, if you like, or certain types of coding with your thoughts, with your consciousness. And that attracts other types of coding or clusters of coding that resonate with where your consciousness is at. So I'm thinking of Nathan Lucius, and I cause a van with his name on to appear at that moment because the coding arranges itself in that way. So
fortunately, you weren't thinking of him in the shower.
Well, yeah. That's a P. Diddy party. That's not what happens here. So I think that's why these things happen all the time, because we've not properly comprehended the true nature of the place in which we find ourselves.
So you could almost say the code, like my Baltimore and Dom's experience, the coding's not being lazy, but taking the easy way out. It's just, instead of grasping something at random, it's been influenced by
what's around it.
What's around us.
But, well, it's limited. You know, if you've got a virtual reality game, I don't play these, but I'm vaguely aware of the concept. Obviously, there are rules. So the coding's been written in a certain way, and you can't go outside of that. So if you're playing a game where you've got to, you know, shoot a bunch of people up, you can't suddenly step into a game where you're on a UFO interacting with aliens, because it's not written into the coding of that game.
And
you can only do what the game's intended for.
Which is very interesting as well, because most of these games, you win by killing more people.
That's right.
Grand Theft Auto, I mean, I've never played Grand Theft Auto, but when I've seen my eldest now, when he used to play it, you actually got more bonuses for carjacking and robbing a shop and more points for doing things like that. Because I said, why are you doing stuff like that?
Well, you make an interesting point, Dom. And I think this goes some way to explaining why the so-called elites, the rulers of organized society, get on so well in this place. Because they've realized what the game is, they know how it's coded, and they know that it's been structured to facilitate fear, pain, suffering, trauma, which is something I've been talking about a lot in my videos this year. You know, not the happiest of subjects. I usually try and leave things on a positive note at the end of it. But they've realized that if you try and align yourself with right action and being kind towards others and trying to help others and trying to do good works and good deeds, you're only going to reap suffering and hardship as a result of doing that. If, on the other hand, you want to trample all over other people's rights, take away their freedoms, violate them, kill them in many cases, harm them, you'll do really well in this place because it's been set up to reward that kind of behavior. You're aligning yourself with the coding. And that would go a long way to explaining why such a small number of so-called elites
stay in power.
In terms of numbers, can control billions of the masses with apparently relative ease.
And not only that, mindfuck everybody into believing that, say, Bitch Tits Gates is actually a good guy.
Right.
In the process.
Oh, and also, somebody's got to explain all this.
Yeah.
But also, they don't actually inflict any damage on anybody. They get us to do it to themselves anyway. They physically, you know, even if you take the past 4 years, they don't go around stabbing fuck, jabbing fuck. They get us to do it to each other. In a war, right. They get us to kill each other. They don't know. They're untouched. So the karma's on us, I suppose, if there is that thing.
So you often hear the claim that the so-called elites are reptilian shape-shifting hybrids or whatever, or they're not fully human. What if they are fully human, but they're just psychopaths? They don't have a conscience, and they've worked out that the way to get ahead in this realm is to dominate and enslave everyone else by aligning yourself with what this place was set up to cultivate in the first place. And that's why they get away with it. They get away literally with murder. And the rest of us suffer great hardships because we're all the time trying to fix this place. We think, oh, we've got to make it better. We've got to kick these bastards out and we can do things so much better if we all come together in unity and stuff. And don't know if you've noticed, but that dynamic's not really going too well. And it's not been going too well throughout all of known human history. And also, I don't know if you've noticed this either, but how many people do you think have been praying since 2020, particularly, but, you know, at any point in human history, praying for a desired outcome? So asking their god of choice, their deity of choice, or even if you don't subscribe to one of the organized religions, then asking creation or source to manifest what you want to see come into existence. And how many of those wishes actually come to pass? How often do prayers get answered? And I just see all kinds of gaslighting going on, all kinds of excuses made. So people will say, they'll pray for something, and if it happens, they'll say, oh, it's a miracle. Oh, God answered my prayer. Isn't it marvelous? But then if it doesn't happen, they'll say, oh, well, God works in a mysterious way and it's not our place to question him. And, you know, it will happen when he's ready. So, you know, if you do get what you've asked for, you say it was God. If you don't get what you've asked for, you say it was God. Well, you're not much further forward, really, are you? Because things might happen or they might not happen.
Yeah. I also think that you just mentioned like a virtual reality. Well, in virtual reality, you sort of get taken over, don't you? It's like an AI parasite, if you like, that takes over you. And I think these people who are in power, and some people call it possession or attachments or whatever, they get into the coding actually takes control of them. That's where I see it, because I've been in business meetings with people like that. It's been sat around the table with them, characters out of Blade, where you explain it, don't you, Chris? That
another coding example actually is, you know, and me and my missus always talk about this, and I've always thought this, that you can go to another country and you'll see someone, for instance, and me and my missus refer to it, oh, they're in the so-and-so clan, for instance. Like, say, you know, one of my mates, they're in the Rick clan, they've got a similar head shape. Look, but you could go to Africa and meet someone with this, and they're in the Rick clan, it doesn't matter whether they're black or white. And that would go into the coding thing, which is, if you're making a video game and you've got 1,000 characters in it, you have 10 base characters, then you add a little difference to each one, and then another difference to another few, and then all of a sudden you've got thousands of different characters, but they're all based on the same base character, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
We all meet people who look like someone we know, but have no business looking that much like someone we know, if you know what I mean.
Like Hinckley and...
Yeah, well, exactly, and they've got two parents, so they should look like those two parents, but they've come out as some clone, half-clone of someone else, you know.
Good point.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of NPCs thrown into the mix.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a totally different story, that, isn't it? I mean, we've but your God series, you've come under a little bit of stick for this. What number are you on now?
I'm on God 11 with 12 to come soon. So it's been roughly one a month. I started it in January. Yeah, I mean, when I first started putting them out, I came under fire and there were a lot of upset people. But I found with each subsequent one, fewer people seem to be getting upset. And what I'm actually getting is more correspondence of support. So a lot of people now are saying, yeah, you know, this is making sense. And I'm getting a lot of emails and comments left on the videos, and people agreeing with what I'm saying or offering their own perspectives on things. So it seems to have really stimulated a lot of thought and consideration in many, many people.
Well, I mean,
never part of the plan.
Well, no, but I mean, stuff you do, you like the God question, nobody likes talking about it because you're scared of upsetting people. But we've just gone through 2020 and 2021 where we now don't give a shit about upsetting people, if you like. With as long as it's got context behind it, you know, we're not just going out of the way to do it.
You shouldn't be upset by a conversation, though. It's not, doesn't mean anyone hates anyone or, you know, you're asking the questions that we've all should be asking his entire lives, which is why we're here and what's it all about.
And where we come from.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with asking them questions, is there?
And if you have faith in your own particular religion, whatever it may be, then you shouldn't get upset about anyone not agreeing with you because, you know, you've decided what you believe and it works for you. So, and if you believe that's the correct faith to have, then why worry about what the next man is saying? You know, that's his lookout.
Shouldn't worry about it or forgive one or the other.
I mean, if there were God, would God bomb Dresden, flatten Japanese cities or Gaza or any cities around the world at any time in human history? Would that God, savior of all mankind, would they kill its own?
Well, he moves in mysterious ways, you see. Not, it's not our place to question.
How dare you?
There is one thing for sure. If you go to any museum or any We're near Duxford. We've got Duxford. We've spent a lot of money and a lot of time and effort on working out how to murder people and each other for thousands and thousands of years. Mm. I mean, has there ever been a peaceful period?
No.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure there has.
Never.
Been,
there's, no, there's, not, there's never been one. Never.
That's right.
I don't think there has. It's been covered up.
Yeah. Well, there's never been a peaceful moment. Humans are violent, evil, bloodthirsty creations. And then they drag everybody up. Oh, there's a section of humans that are like that, and they drag everybody else into it, like World War One. It creates more killers. Mm. World War One, World War Two, wars create people who one day they're lawn mowing the lawn, next day they're throwing a grenade over the fence, like what happened in the Balkans in the '90s.
Mm. Yeah,
and people will say this place is here to facilitate what our souls need to grow and evolve. And I kind of went with that way of thinking for many years because it's a bit like the de facto spiritual stance that you get in the so-called truth movement. So, you know, the minute you realize this world is nothing like we thought it was and it's run by psychopathic elites and secret societies and stuff, the next stage on from that is to kind of question the nature of this reality in the first place. And you'll probably find yourself being swept along with that train of thought, which is, oh, well, you know, we consented on a soul level to come in here and have these experiences and it's for our own benefit and stuff. But is it really? You know, how much suffering does one individual need to undergo? And also try saying that to the families of a child that's been abducted by a paedophile gang or something, you know, and had all kinds of horrors inflicted on it. Or how about a victim of satanic ritual abuse or trauma-based mind control? You know, you're going to tell me that they chose that kind of life because their soul wanted to learn those lessons, yeah? No, I don't think so. I don't think anyone would have chosen
even
that
the most positive person. And we try and stay positive and upbeat, but even the most positive people can see this is there's a dark energy running this place. It has been for thousands of years. When you do the bloodlines, it's just all warmongering and everything. Even if you're like me and Chris, as you know, we like having a joke and a laugh. But even then, it is a dark place, isn't it? Whether we like it or not.
Like Mark said, I think it's Satan's world. Wherever it, I'm not saying like a horned devil, but I think even
it can't be Chris because whichever god you choose, it's all powerful.
Well, one thing I will say, I mean, I think we've been designed there's a design process that's gone on to create us and all the other creatures and everything else. I mean, the whole Earth, you know, left alone without humor, it works in unison with itself, doesn't it? It's a self-.
Well, I would say, Chris, we don't belong here.
We don't belong here, yeah.
Yeah, I've said that for a long time, that we are the odd ones out on this planet.
We're in the wrong realm, if you like.
Yes.
Because otherwise...
We've been superimposed.
Well, we won't get sunburnt, we won't get backaches, these animals don't get these things, do they? They can live out in the... We need somewhere to live in this realm. And any animal can live anywhere, just out in the wild. They don't care.
They don't pay mortgages.
You don't even get energy drain. They might get murdered for food, but they belong here, don't they?
Another question, Chris, as well, which I've been raising in this God series. Why is the animal world, the natural world, so-called, so brutal and horrific? Why do creatures need to murder each other every single day in their billions just to stay alive? Why did it have to be designed that way? Why does the human body even need to take in food? It's not that difficult to see how things could have been done differently, and we could have been designed in a way whereby we don't need to take in any.
But maybe, Mark, we're going to evolve into that air-feeding... I'm joking there, by the way.
If you take the Lion King level of out in the wilderness, Serengeti, wherever it was, they keep the animals to the right level. I mean, it all works quite beautiful. I know it's horrible because they get ripped apart or whatever, but it all works in unison with each other. Until we get involved, yeah.
It's still terror, though, isn't it? Mm. A zebra getting dragged into a marsh in Serengeti by a crocodile, if crocodiles are in Serengeti. Probably got that all wrong.
But then again, on a micro level, like, could we say that about the bacteria on our arms or our ears or whatever? You know,
your nostrils.
My nostrils, or the, you know, the killing
your kitchen.
Yeah. I don't know. We, you know what? The answer is we haven't got a frigging clue.
Well, one thing
and,
I would
and all Mark's trying to do is find, you know,
just ask questions and get answers, because we're inquisitive beings. Hence why we do this type of research. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts on that, Mark? That we don't belong here. We've been inserted here, and we're usurpers, if you like.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. We are different from all other species in ways that Chris outlined there. I just feel that we have been tricked or coerced into living these lives in some way by whatever entity created this place. I no longer believe that there was consent. I don't believe that we agreed to come here and undergo these lives. You know, that's something that used to pacify me for many years, and you draw comfort from the idea that, oh, well, you know, it's all happening by consent and we've not been forced here, but I think we probably have, actually.
Oh, yeah, we've been tricked here, or forced, maybe. Who knows?
It's not our home. We know this place is not our home. Mm. We know we don't belong here.
Yeah. I think so.
Instinctively.
You don't feel like you're from here. You don't feel like you fit in.
No.
Because everything works.
Oh, no, you're a darky living in Yorkshire.
in a small rural village. Yeah.
You definitely don't belong there.
I've never missed that dartboard. I've lost my train there now, Chris. It's all right. Not wrong with a bit of 80s racism. No. Just to bring us all, make it sober us all up again.
Don't you feel like you don't belong in the average Wetherspoons as well, though? Because you're in there and you hear blokes talking about football or whatever.
Oh, God.
I don't belong in any average stuff like that.
EastEnders, and you can be sat there thinking, I don't belong here. This, you know,
it's definitely like bigger things people to talk about right now. It's definitely bigger things to discuss. Mind you, then again, I go on and talk about films, so.
I was talking to someone today who told me that he went out on his bike 2 years ago and his mate collapsed on his bike. Had a stroke. Didn't get into any conversation. You know where I wanted to go with that conversation.
How old was he?
Our age. Fit guy. Mm. But these are conversations you're having regular now since 2021 with people. So how can you have conversations? I hear people, when my Ewan's playing football, I listen to him, such and such popped it, didn't they? You never had this conversation at a little kid's football match. You know, one of the fathers is going through major health concern, well, not a concern, chemotherapy and all this kind of stuff. It just didn't happen.
Look at that one the other week, though. I went out.
I know we've got on to something totally different now. But
well, I mean, you could say this were a synchronicity, but I went out in the village near us, me and my missus, and just saw an old boy lying in the street, and they were rushing around. I think when they went to the pub and
Wuhan?
So a defib open, and this old boy's lying on it, and they got coats over him. And about a week later, you saw the same thing, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. But you've never seen stuff like that before. But anyway, that's another superimposed thing. That is like a video game. That is like we're living a video. And then you've got in America Trump being voted in. He's going to drain the swamp again with Elon Musk this time and Bobby Kennedy. We can't string two words together.
Well, the world just feels like a totally different place, doesn't it? I mean, I'm not even talking about world events like current affairs. Mm. It's just the whole construct just feels different to me. Yeah. If we think, you know, we're roughly the same age, we grew up in the 70s and 80s, and the world just seemed completely different then.
Yeah.
It just feels like we've slipped into some sort of alternate reality to me.
Yeah.
Nothing's the same.
I was watching... I'm enjoying watching some old films lately. Me and my missus watching a bit of The Godfather the other day. And Michael Corleone's in New York when his dad gets shot, you know, The Godfather. And he goes to he sees it in a newspaper before he finds out. And you think, because it's all analogue, obviously there's no, you know, they haven't got any phones or anything. And he goes to a phone box and rings his brother and he goes, "Where have you been? His dad's been shot." And he said, "I know, I just saw it in a newspaper." And you think, my God, there's something... So
these
far
days
it'd
be on TikTok.
Yeah, instantaneously.
Instantaneously they'd have known. And the whole world would have known at the same time.
Instant terror.
But there's something nice about that, isn't there?
It's the analogue world.
Yeah.
You knew in DJing, Mark, when you were playing decks and you were mixing, there was a certain skill to that, weren't there? We spoke about this before.
Yeah.
Certain skill to mixing songs in together, etc., and making sure they went together. There was a certain art form to that. And then as soon as CD playing came in, it took all that away, didn't it? And then now it's totally different again.
Well, especially with laptop DJing, because now you've got 5,000 tracks at your instant disposal. So you can pull a track in and play 30 seconds of it and then chop into the next track. You try doing that with vinyl. You know, back in the day, you had to select that record. You had to know where to find it in the crate, what the sleeve looked like, pull it out, you know, line up the grooves in your headphones.
Yeah. In the dark.
Mix it in by ear, by ear, using your personal skill, not using a sync button on the laptop. So things were very different then. But it just felt more authentic, and people valued the DJ more back in those days as well, because these days you're just some twat with a laptop. But back in the day, you had to exhibit some skill to be up there on the decks.
Definitely. And now anybody does it, don't they? It's an automaton. I'm not saying like it was playing the decks. Now it's gone like all the other jobs, automatron, hasn't it? Where you see somebody who never played before, now they're famous. Forget that there were a girl who were playing. Never heard of her. She's playing in front of this massive crowd, stadium crowd, and she couldn't play at decks. All she's got is a laptop.
Yeah. Well, Paris Hilton became
that's
a DJ.
Who it was. Paris Hilton, yeah.
Which tells you all you need to know. So she's obviously miming a pre-mixed set that somebody's created for her. And she's just stood there waving her arms in the air and getting paid £100,000 for doing so. So, yes, anyone can be a DJ now.
Which totally fucks it up, doesn't it? I noticed it changed after the millennium. I think a lot of things changed after circa 2000, 2001, which was another, again, after 2020 it went dark, but 2001 was as well. So a lot of people say to me, oh, it's because you're getting older that you think it's changing and everyone, you know, looks a bit more pessimistic back and looks through rose-tinted spectacles and all this type of stuff. Sorry, pessimistic for the future and rose-tinted spectacles for the past. But in 2001, it changed, didn't it? It went dark. Then I remember it feeling totally different after the towers went down as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the Matrix movie was released 2 years before the events of 9/11. And I really feel that the creators of that film were onto something in terms of telling us about the true nature of this construct.
Well, look, we're certainly ahead of the time now. They're both late, both women.
Do you think they were put there to do that, though, Matt? Because now, you know what? If they hadn't both turned into women, I wouldn't have thought they were part of the system.
You might think they were on our side.
Yeah, because they made The Matrix, then they made Cloud Atlas.
Yep.
And they also made
V for Vendetta.
V for Vendetta. And they produced V for Vendetta, but they also made that other one, Jupiter Rising, which is about a load of aliens who basically feed off each planet, which I thought it was a very underrated film. I thought it was quite interesting. But they made these almost old school work films, what you'd say, you know, talking about some very interesting stuff. But it almost
woke
seemed
as hell now, aren't they?
But then they went down the both. I mean, what's the chances of that? Because you're a brother, me and Dom Kim, trying it. I mean, it's just bizarre.
I don't see what blonde wig.
And they were very early on as well in the transgender thing, weren't they? Right.
I mean, mid-2000s, weren't they?
Is it mid-2000s?
It might have been mid-2000s.
Yeah, I reckon.
Yeah, it probably was. Maybe first that one was their punishment. Maybe it was like, you know, Stanley Kubrick put too much truth in his film, so they killed him.
Yeah.
And with them, they were like, right, you can go the Stanley Kubrick way, or you can become women.
Put
your choice.
Pink wig on. Yeah.
You have to ask.
You know what? It sounds ridiculous, man, but we don't know how their system works. Maybe there is some truth in that, a humiliation truth.
Stranger things have happened, as it turns out.
Who knows? Maybe it's the truth.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be shocking, would it? Because I always say to Dom, that
nothing's shocking anymore.
No.
It seems like their system is just a totally different system to ours, and we'll never know the ins and outs of how these things work and how they run.
But don't you think it's just totally ridiculous and absurd as well? So in my last God video, I showed a bunch of clips from Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. And I've made the statement many times that life these days is like a Monty Python sketch gone live, because it just feels completely ridiculous to the point that the only appropriate reaction is to laugh at it.
Yeah, it's take the piss.
I mean, that one in Life of Brian, where they're talking about when he's on about being a woman. Fucking hell. Yeah. Did you watch that now?
40 years ahead of the curve.
I'm surprised they haven't banned it.
Maybe they have.
Maybe they have.
They got into trouble for Life of Brian at the time, didn't they, with Christians?
Yeah.
You got very upset about it.
But he's not actually supposed to be Jesus, is he? He's supposed to be Brian. I mean, that film's amazing. It very intelligent, ridiculous comedy. But it's an, I've watched that dozens of times. Fantastic film.
And well, those guys knew some stuff. The Monty Python guys, you know, yeah, coming out of Oxford and Cambridge universities, yeah, I think they were well schooled in a lot of truth, real truth.
And that information I sent you over about the Revenant, Terry Gillingham's that guy's mate as well. The producer Aaron Milliken. Who directed The Revenant?
Arnon Milchin,
that's him. That guy, Arnon Milchin. Got his name wrong. I'm from Yorkshire, that's how we pronounce it.
Is there any programming in The Revenant? Because it's kind of an old cowboy, isn't it?
Well, it's a pretty miserable watch.
I've never watched it.
It just kind of reinforces how hard life is and how it's full of pain and suffering.
And how unfair it is.
Yeah, yeah.
I would imagine it's got a bit of it. I haven't actually watched that film. I mean, Mrs. has watched it, but I would guess it's got some eco stuff in it, but I'm not sure because I've never seen it.
Well, it's just a very tough watch, you know. It also reinforces how brutal the natural world is again. You know, there's Native Americans killing bisons, and spoiler alert, Leo DiCaprio's character to survive has to take the guts out of a horse that's dead and then climb inside the horse's carcass to keep warm.
Like Luke Skywalker.
Yeah,
like Luke Skywalker. There must be some esoteric symbology in there somewhere.
Well, bound to be.
But again, a lot of these films are just made there, put there to terrorize you, aren't they? Terrorize your mind. That's why I never watched it. My miss said it was really disturbing. I think I've got a bit soft.
I mean, it's great filmmaking. It's an amazing movie from the point of view of the cinematography and the story, but it's not a happy watch. It's bloody hard going.
Famous director, I forgot who it is.
Alejandro.
Spanish guy, yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, now you found out it was funded by Israeli intelligence. Puts a different light on it, doesn't it, Chris?
A little bit.
I think Mark called him a piece of shit, didn't he? I think you said that Robert De Niro, my favourite actor, didn't you, Mark?
He's a close personal pal of this guy, yeah, Arnon, yeah, isn't he?
Yeah. Just shows, again, what we're witnessing, how all this stuff just gone through.
No, we were saying what we'd done at the time. Do you remember when Robert De Niro came out with the Vax film at his film festival? And he was on the news, like, saying, no, we want to show it because, you know, I've got an autistic child. Maybe, it was, you know, we should have this information out here, etc. And then me and Dom were joking. And all of a sudden, we were doing a Warburton's advert. Was that part of the punishment? I'm sure he wouldn't have thought his resume as, a, you know, one of...
A bread advert.
Modern world's best advert actors.
I can't figure him out because he wouldn't have had a career lasting the multiple decades that his has if he wasn't completely beholden to the system. So then what was he doing putting out this Vax film? You would imagine that would be information they wouldn't want out there. So was that controlled for some reason?
I don't know.
You know, he's on Epstein's bloody flight logs, so it's not looking too good for him.
A lot of his latter films, he's been playing normal characters that are CIA agents, aren't they? In the Meet the Flockers. Fockers, sorry, not I'm thinking of what we do. Meet the Fockers. He was an undercover CIA agent, and as I mean, there's a lot of talk that he played that in the Matt Damon film as well. What's that called now? He was a CIA intelligence.
Good
so he's gone from gangster.
Good Shepherd.
Yeah, Good Shepherd. That would
he directed film. It. He directed it. I've never seen that film either. Actually,
yeah. It's a bit of a going. It goes on a bit, but it's quite a good film.
There is a chance that he basically ruins a Tribeca film festival. That Vax film just slipped through the net. Then it got loads of attention, but then because he's got an autistic child and it links to that, maybe when he was making those TV appearances, I think he only made one. Maybe it was from a heartfelt position, and then like I said, he got told to shoot.
You'll never know, will you?
We'll never know. No. I mean, yeah. Again, that could all be a fucking stage show, and he's supposed to put that appearance in. We just don't know, do we? We just don't know. These are actors acting, aren't they?
Well, I personally don't trust any of them.
No.
Me neither, Matt.
No, I can't trust. Not when they're funded by Israeli intelligence operatives. I can't support.
All the heroes are long, long gone. Thanks to you, yes. Mark.
Yeah.
Well, glad to have been of service.
Yeah.
Now, I still get when I do talks, I had it at the weekend. People will say, oh yeah, I can see how the whole music business is completely controlled and you can't have a career unless you're doing the bidding of the elites and such. except for my favourite band. My favourite band weren't like that. They were too smart. Oh, they weren't taken in. No, they were putting their own messages out and making their own statements. Didn't get my favourite band. I still get that from people.
Yeah.
There's still denial runs deep.
Do you think there's a few, right? And I'm not going on that bandwagon, by the way. Just for instance, I went to watch on Saturday last week. Got the jazz festival on here. I went to watch Omar. Do you remember Omar, Matt?
Oh, yeah. There's, soul there's singer. Like this.
Yeah. Him. Yeah. And he's never gone mental. What I mean is, do you think there's some that get
he's
offered?
Not mainstream, though, is he, Chris, really?
Yeah, but he's considered one of England's most famous soul singers.
He is, but he's not a household name.
No, he's not. No, anyone who I said I was going to watch him didn't know who he was. But do you think at some point, whether they know it or not, they're given the offer, and then if they don't, you know, behave how the offer's handed to them, then they just ignored, or they may be even blatantly given an offer and they just retract?
I think there's levels to it. So you have certain artists that are there just to kind of pad out the industry, and so that the industry can keep ticking along and making money for the record labels. And the artists aren't kind of up to their necks in all kinds of sordid stuff. Not at that level. That comes a few levels up. So I met a lot of these artists when I was a DJ back in the day. You know, I interviewed Omar, and I was just thinking about Beverly Knight earlier, actually, because I met Beverly Knight when she first came out with Flavor of the Old School, 1995. Yeah. And that's before she'd really broken through and become a household name artist. And then she must have been elevated up and made an offer, because in recent times she did that ad, of course, promoting the old arm spear to the black community. So there was this ad that was aimed at those from the black community that had not been taking it up. And so they wheeled out.
Bammy, like, wasn't it? Bammy.
Sir Lenny Henry.
Yeah.
Adrian Lester, and Beverly Knight was on that ad. And when I saw that ad, I thought, oh, okay, you know, Beverly's in the big time now. Otherwise, they wouldn't have bothered getting her on this thing. You know, Omar didn't get to that level, but she did. So there are levels, there are grades to this whole thing.
He was fantastic, by the way. I mean, I had his first album when I was like 17. And he was brilliant. Very good. I really enjoyed it. I bought he's doing it with a four-piece jazz band. They were fantastic. Yeah.
They were all CIA agents, Chris. That's the fuck you plan upon it.
But it's true, like you said, because, I mean, I guess the place where it was, only he had 200, maybe 300, 250, 300 people. But if I was him and I was a musician, I'd love to be playing. I love those little personal, small gigs like that. I think they're fantastic.
Tell me, I've had music industry insiders and people that have been in bands and producers, and they've told me that they reached a point in their career where they were called into a meeting and they were offered a taste of the big time. And they said, how would you like to be elevated up a few rungs up the ladder? You know, all you got to do is sign here, do what we tell you, and you can have all this wealth and fame and privilege. And these people have said something didn't feel right about it. And they just said, no, thank you. Don't want it. And at that point, before you sign anything, they will let you walk out of the door, is what I've been told.
Makes sense.
So you can carry on being an Omar, no disrespect to Omar, but, you know, somebody of that sort of level. You can carry on bubbling away for two or three decades at that level, never rising above it, and make a decent living for yourself and, you know, have a fan base and all that, but not sell your soul. And that might explain why some of these people go on to do just that and never really break through to the major big time.
Right, I'm going to throw away all my Olly Murs CDs.
Yeah, it would. I mean, there's certain ones, mainly a lot of the ones I've actually seen live. I saw Average White Band there as well. And they got big, but they never, and they've got a following, but they were never pushed to that level, that Taylor Swift level, all very talented musicians.
I hope Taylor Swift's in your book, Mark.
Well, Charlemagne is.
Yeah.
Crops up bloody everywhere.
Yeah, I know.
I've got a suspicion, me, that Taylor Swift's a fella, and one day she's going to they're going to reveal it. And that's, I think, or someone, I'm not saying she definitely is, or someone like her, and they're going to come out as, I've been a fella all along.
A crying game moment.
Yeah, literally a crying game moment. I mean, she's 6 foot, she's nearly 6 foot tall, that
Well, that's why she goes out with that massive American football guy.
Yeah.
Who were paid $30 million to push Pfizer's arm spears during 2020.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right, Max, shall we leave it there? We'll let you get off and open a can of beer.
All right, mate. Yeah, well, I'm having tonight off, but I'll have one tomorrow for sure.
Right, yeah. I've one of those.
Will do.
All right, well, thanks for joining us.
Do we want to mention the event in March with
Above? Yeah. Why not?
Probably should.
Yeah. Ironically, go on, Chris, you explain.
Yeah, you know, when we agreed to do it, I didn't even tell them on the night. So we agreed to do the March thing, and the day they've booked is my daughter's birthday.
The only day in the year.
But I didn't know till we were doing a live show with them on a Friday, and I'm sat at the computer, and they've got ticker tape going down the bottom of their screen saying, live event with Sheep Farm, Mark Devlin, da, 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 March the 8th. My daughter's birthday. Shit. So I'm still doing it, and it's going to cost me a fortune.
Payback, Chris.
Yeah. No, to be fair, the missus said, as long as you're there in the morning, dads don't really have a lot to do with children's birthday parties, though. You just got to buy the stuff.
Wait till the teenage years, mate.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. So I'm doing the birthday, then zooming down there after. But yeah, it'll be fine.
Yeah, no, it'll be a good one, though. It's already sold out, I think, Mark, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, Lance says it has. So it's in Bournemouth at a hotel. Do you remember the name of it? I can't remember the name.
No, I can't remember the name of it. You're fucking useless at pushing this out.
It's a hotel in Bournemouth, but it's sold out anyway. It's Rise Above. It's Lance, Andy, PG, you guys, Sheep Farm, and myself. And it's going to be similar to the event you did at Pennine Manor, I guess, where we're just going to be informally interacting with the crowd and presenting our research. I'll be dropping a DJ set, and should be good fun. Imagine good fun.
We're going to arrange another talking up in Huddersfield, Mark, at some point.
They went very well, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were brilliant. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was a good time, wasn't it?
I'll try and get my son to come down to Bournemouth, Mark. Meet him. He's the one who did the Sheep Farm theme tune.
The Sting song, Englishmen in New York? Two Northerners in Bournemouth.
Yeah. We'll stand out like a sore thumb.
We probably will.
We should find it. I've been saying to Christian, we need to find a spot in Cambridge. Because just somewhere down in the middle.
Illuminati Central.
Yeah.
Yeah. Belly of the Beast.
Yeah.
I cycle past AstraZeneca on my way to my chef job.
The weapons that kill.
Yeah. I know people who work there, actually.
Do they have red eyes? We're not doing ourselves any favours, really. You're in Cambridge, I'm in Oxford. People are like, I told you there were Illuminati shields.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it?
Yeah, no doubt we'll get a load of grief for this. But anyway, tough shit. That's how it is.
Yeah.
All right, then. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in. If you're joining us in part two, we'll see you there. If not, we'll see you next week. Bye.
Cheers, bye.
Bye. Sky.